I'm Dominic from the NFL Power Hour. You're listening to CGLO 1690 AM in Montreal.
Protesters gathered outside of the United States Consulate in Montreal this week to demand an end to the war in Iran. The protest was organized by the Iranian Canadian Congress and the Palestinian Youth Movement. It was initially scheduled after President Donald Trump threatened to take out an entire civilization. Almost 24 hours before the protest, a ceasefire was made between the United States and Iran, though peace in the Middle East did not seem to last long, as hundreds of people were killed and injured in Lebanon by Israeli attacks. Mona Ghazemi, the president of the ICC, said it was another reason to hold a protest.
People felt that it was urgent to get in the streets to oppose those, frankly, genocidal statements by U.S. President Donald Trump. As well, yesterday there was additional hundreds of people in Lebanon who were killed, so it was a joint protest organized by the Palestinian Youth Movement and an Iranian Canadian Congress, and also featuring Lebanon, of course, which we know is joint in the struggles of the people of the region.
Prime Minister Mark Carney welcomed the news of the ceasefire, calling it a positive development. Pakistani and Iranian officials have said the ceasefire agreement included Lebanon, while Israel and the U.S. have denied those claims. Prime Minister Carney on Wednesday said Canada wants to see the inclusion of Lebanon.
We say peace, we mean peace in the region, including Lebanon.
Mona and others who were at the protest want to see more action from the Canadian government.
We also want our Canadian government to take the right side and take the side of international law, really, because in previous statements, Mark Carney had supported the attacks against Iran with, you know, the claims that, you know, Iran had was moving towards becoming a nuclear power with nuclear weapons. We've heard these claims many, many times over the years. Netanyahu likes to bring them forward every time as an excuse. But what we hope to see is a lasting peace, and a lasting peace can only come through justice. So, in the at the level of international law, we think that Iran should be treated equally and not demonized in the way it has been.
Canada's Foreign Affairs Minister Anita Anand in February said a regime change would be needed to form a diplomatic relationship with Iran. Regime change has been one reason for the attacks from the United States, among many others. In February, Donald Trump told the Washington Post, "All I want is freedom for the people." Remarks that Mona approaches with caution.
Be careful and take a critical view of any foreign power which claims to be attempting to save another independent nation.
While peace in the Middle East seems to be uncertain, it is certain that protesters want the war to end.
For CGLO News, I'm Zach Jutra.
Good evening, everybody. You are listening to our show Towards a Common Horizon on CGLO 1690. Happy Sunday evening. We are, if you haven't heard from us before and if you haven't tuned in already, we are the Montreal chapter of a national organization called Common Horizon, where we are building a mass movement of everyday people. We come together to take power away from the billionaire class and win solutions to the climate crisis that secure good jobs, address affordability, and ensure a dignified life for all. We have chapters across the country in Victoria, Vancouver, Edmonton, Calgary, Montreal, and Toronto. And every 2 weeks, like today, we'll be here on Sunday at 8 p.m. chatting about all things climate and affordability and connecting the dots between systems of inequality and climate collapse, and hopefully shining some solutions on things that can address the many crises that we face today. So my name is Hope, and I'm joined today by Haley.
Hello.
And we'll be your host today. I'm so cheery, but yeah, today we're going to be chatting about some not so cheery things, as per usual, maybe, but hopefully add some hope towards the end. So today we'll be chatting about the Canadian and global oil industries war profiteering, the newly announced federal suspension of the excise tax on gas, diesel, and aviation fuel. And we're also going to try to wrap our heads around what even billions of dollars looks like in more tangible ways. I think there's a lot of numbers flying around these days, and it's always a nice exercise to be able to try to make them a little bit more tangible, make them a little bit more quantifiable to the average person, because not all of us are billionaires. So, but yeah, before we get too into that, I'm just going to do a little quick ad break. So see you after this.
Want to know the easiest way to help out your favorite community radio station? Well, there's this thing called the Community Radio Initiative. The National Campus and Community Radio Association and stations from across the country, like ours, are asking the federal government for direct funding for our sector. For CGLO's part, there are so many people at our station that are truly passionate about radio, and getting that funding would allow us to do so much more on and off the air. So if you want to help us out, head on over to mycri.ca. There's a letter writing campaign going on right now, and on that site, you'll find a tool that will generate an email for your MP and a bunch of other ministers in about 30 seconds. Again, that site is mycri.ca. Thanks for your support.
Dust off your boots, pour some sweet tea, and tune in to the freshest of folk, roots, indie, and more, along with some favorites of the past. The best of old and new meet together in The Alley every Friday at 11 a.m. only on CJLO 1690 AM.
Hey, what's up? This is Charlie from Black Country New Road, and you are listening to CJLO 1690 AM.
Hello, hello. Welcome back. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to CJLO 1690 AM, and you're listening to our show called Towards a Common Horizon, where we talk all things climate and politics. So at the top of the hour, I was explaining how we're going to talk a little bit about oil. I feel like this has been a topic we've already talked a little bit about in our shows before, if you've listened in. But if you haven't realized already, We're in a bit of an oil crisis, so it makes sense that we're going to keep talking about this as a show interested in climate and affordability and politics. Yeah, in case you are avoiding the news, or you haven't read the news for a little while, or even honestly because the news changes a lot every single day, I'm going to give a quick Strait of Hormuz update. So for those who don't know, the Strait of Hormuz is an essential passageway for ships to pass through from the Persian Gulf into the Gulf of Oman, where typically around 20% of global oil is transported from producers, a lot of Middle Eastern producers of oil like Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Iraq, and Qatar to make to global markets, usually Asian-dominated, but some of this volume is, in fact, purchased by Europe. So yeah, about 20%, a fifth of the global oil passes through the Strait of Hormuz every single day. But since the 28th of February, when Israel and the U.S. first targeted Iran, and then subsequent actions on Lebanon, Iran has largely blockaded and now has completely blockaded the Strait of Hormuz. And this has triggered a global oil shortage and has essentially led us to this unfolding oil crisis that we are in today. And so, yeah, it's been about 8 weeks, I think, what is it, like 50 days or something, of steadily increasing prices of oil, increasing lack of supply in terms of the global supply chains of oil. That has obviously led many consumers around the world to either be in various positions of not being able to access basic oil that they need to grow their foods or have fertilizer production. That's largely the issues that are being faced in Asia, where a lot of this oil is their primary source. But here over in the West, it's looked like increased gas prices and generally increased costs of, you know, everything that kind of oil touches or energy touches, which is basically everything. So this is an interesting time for sure. And I think what we're going to talk about a little bit today is how this oil crisis has some people, most of the world, really struggling, but very few are absolutely raking it in, and they are actually having a great time. And so we're going to talk a little bit about the global oil windfall. Haley, do you know what a windfall is?
Yeah, so a windfall is when, you know, certain conditions create, like this oil crisis, the opportunity for a corporation or a group of different corporations in industry to make just massive, massive profits above what they would usually make. And so in this case, you know, oil companies usually make a standard percentage like of profit. And in this case, because of the shortages and the closures through the Strait of Hormuz, because some Saudi Arabia companies can't get their oil to market, other companies are then selling it for a much, much higher price because of like the free market capitalism that we're under. But what is really interesting is like when we are buying oil in Canada and like, you know, the gas station prices are so much more like elevated, you know, none of the, like, it's not like there was like a shortage of Saudi Arabian oil really that's affecting this. Like when, before this crisis, like I think a percentage of Saudi Arabian oil that would have passed through the Strait of Hormuz that was coming to Canada was very, very small. I think below 15% or less. I think it was something like 10. And so, you know, the prices are not actually up because we're like losing out on all of this oil and gas. Like the majority of the gas, you know, that you're getting at the gas station here is pumped from, or is coming from Canada. Some of it from the US. There's like complications of like where it's refined. But basically these Canadian oil companies, like they are just making pure profit. They are, you know, their costs have not gone up, but what they can charge because of the global price of oil has just skyrocketed. And so what they are making is just pure profit. And so a reporting came out in the Financial Times putting the estimate of like if oil prices stay at this elevated rate, the amount that the Canadian oil companies stand to make is $90 billion in a year. Again, that is $90 billion. We're going to get a little bit more into you know, what exactly that means. But like a quick stat that I found pretty flooring was like, okay, Hope, well, maybe you know this already, but like basically the cost that the UN puts on how much it would cost to end world hunger, not just in Canada, but like around the entire globe. Do you remember what it is?
I don't. And I would love to play this guessing game because I don't even know. I feel like it's like, it's definitely within that 90 billion.
It's 93. So just okay. We're 3 billion short, but like really not by a lot. So it's just like, it's maddening. And like, this is not money that is like, you know, being spread across a lot of people. This is going to CEOs, to executives, and to shareholders. I think the other thing that's really interesting that we're seeing is like often the argument by people who are big capitalists would say, well, yes, they're making massive profits, but like they're going to reinvest it. And, you know, it's going to create jobs and all that. And what's being reported, like not even like in lefty media rags, but like on like oil news websites, is that they're actually not reinvesting the money either. Like they're just taking this as pure profit.
Well, and yeah, that's, I think, a really good point. Like the if we're using this, yeah, if we're kind of imagining the conservative argument of like, oh, well, you know, like oil or like, you know, they deserved it. They like worked really hard and, you know, they're just making a bonus. I think it's important to realize like this $90 billion is truly excess. So like this is a bonus for them. It's not in their regular earnings. Like their regular earnings are already skyrocketing all the time. This is in addition to. So it's just kind of inconceivable how much extra money is being made right now.
I think the other thing to talk about is also like, you know, they're just making this profit doing nothing. And like the reason that this is happening is so horrific and ugly. Like 1,700 Iranian civilians have been killed so far in the war, and the number of injuries is so much higher. The number of people being displaced, the number of critical infrastructure that is being taken out, and you know, like horrific threats of like Donald Trump being like, "I'm gonna wipe out a civilization. I'm gonna bomb you back to the Stone Age." Like, this is what Canadian oil companies are profiting off of.
It's pure war profiteering, plain and simple.
Yeah, it's not innovation. It's not like they like invented a better pump. Like, it's just pure evil profit.
It's pretty gross. We're talking about Canada, but I think an interesting stat too that is just mind-blowing is globally, the world's top 100 oil and gas companies, in the first month of the U.S.-Israeli war with Iran, those top 100 oil and gas companies banked more than $30 million every hour in unearned profit just in that first month. So $30 million every hour. Like, what?
I cannot
imagine
conceive.
That's your hourly rate. Yes, I'll just have 30 minutes. Like, what does that mean? And so that was according to The Guardian. I think it's important to recognize that this is war profiteering, but it's also profiteering off of the everyday people. So this money, this excess, all these excess profits, that $30 million every hour, this projected $90 billion, that is from everyday people paying for their energy because the speculative price is higher because there's you know, less demand or less supply. There's certainly more demand, if anything, now. But like, all of this excess money is from ordinary people. So we are seeing a massive shift and enlarging even further of this gulf between the ordinary but working person and the rich here, because we are just siphoning all of our money, all of our excess money that we actually don't have. It's not even excess for us. Our average money towards these excess profits that these large corporations are taking from us.
And it's I think it's important to remember it's not just folks like we talk a lot about people at the pump, but it's not just people buying gas. It's also, you know, like, we don't have cars, but I mean, my Caminato, like, I got the email. They were like, we're putting the prices up, which I was like, yeah. I mean, the company would go under if they can't.
Yeah.
Energy, groceries.
I mean, everything. Transportation is how we get everything, and so it's like anything that has to do with transporting anything from A to B, that's going to have an oil price that's going up.
And the grocery, there's already been reports that grocery producers are saying that they are going to add an increase to their prices because of this. So everything is going up.
And so in Canada, the last kind of oil spike was in 2022 with the war in Ukraine. And that cost average households in Canada about $17,000 just in
per household. Wow.
In increased prices. And so, I mean, a lot of people probably just colloquially know that as like inflation, like increased inflation. Maybe that's going to be the code word again this time, but maybe it will be more directly known as war and oil, because that was what it was that time too. But a lot of people just called it this like mystical kind of fetishized inflation, whatever that means. Most people are just like, okay, sure, let it happen. And I think it's a little bit nicer when we can identify what is actually causing it. I think that kind of brings in this idea of what has happened in terms of recovery efforts that the federal government has done in the past. And so back in 2022, the federal government introduced a one-time 15% tax on excess pandemic profits from the financial sector. And so that kind of allowed for like some collection of excess profits that could be distributed back to everyday people. But I think that using that logic, we can see where the ambition was in 2022 and apply that to now. And so if we were to even just do a 15% tax on this excess profit that the oil industry is having, that could generate $9 billion over the next 12 months. But that's like a pretty moderate, like unambitious floor.
Yeah, let's
I
go
think.
Higher.
Like, let's go higher. Like, so the Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives, they've got a couple models out there. Yeah, if we did like a 33% windfall tax on profits above 120% of like pre-crisis profit levels. So again, this is all like just on the excess profit. That could generate $18 billion, so double over the next 12 months. But then also, I mean, here at Common Horizon, we talk a lot about excess profit taxes, and we refer a lot to the wartime efforts in the 1940s. Mm-hmm. And so if we were to do that ambitious of an excess profits tax of a 75% tax, then that could give us $46 billion over the next year. So it could kind of rake in at least half, if not more, depending on the kind of how you're crunching the numbers and what scenarios you're taking. It could really bring that all of those profits back into the hands of the public.
Yeah. And to make it clear, so people who are maybe a little bit more conservative than us don't freak out, it's, you know, when they're taxing 75%, you know, that's not taking 75% of the profits, all the profits that the company is making. I might want that of oil companies, nationalize it. But what was done during the war, World War II effort, was there basically you're saying like, okay, these companies that make, you know, machinery, that are making tires, all these things that can be used for the war effort. And it was very interesting. It was actually very philosophical because in World War I, there's a ton of war profiteering. And so when you looked at like pre-war, post-war, World War I, regular people became much poorer and the corporate elite became much richer. And, you know, this was to us like a huge moral issue, but to the government in World War II, what they're saying is like this is like a huge morale issue. We need to make sure that this things are fair. So they just looked at what the companies were making pre-crisis, and they said, okay, you can make that. Anything above that, we're taxing 75%. And they actually even went up to 100% at the end of the war with a, I think it was like 20 or something of it they would get back at the end. Like governments and our government has had the guts to do these kinds of things. And I think like this crisis is really like, you know, for a while, Common Horizon has been organizing around climate and affordability for a while, but I feel like this oil crisis is like really putting into stark relief like why we're organizing these two issues together, like why they're so related, because like as we're saying with the Ukraine war and now this, like our dependence on oil and gas is a huge affordability issue, because when it is we have these like global price shocks with such a volatile resource that is so tightly controlled by a small amount of companies that creates these sort of monopolies, whereas with renewables, I mean, our dream is a lot of it being state owned so that we're actually, you know, like not profiting and we're like making like reasonable profits and blah, 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 putting it back into the country. But it also just like is more spread out. And so you don't have these like insane bottlenecks like the Strait of Hormuz. And so you won't have these same like crazy price shocks. It is interesting the way that like other countries have been responding in terms of affordability. Pakistan made in multiple major cities all of their public transportation free. There's also been in France attempts to do price controls on oil. Like, so instead of like taxing it, they're saying like, oh, you can only sell it with a certain amount of profit margin. Just thinking about, if we had mass rapid public transportation, you know, if the shipping of our food systems was not so reliant on oil, like we would be much, much less vulnerable to this as an affordability issue. And we would have a less serious climate crisis on our hands. So that's why they go hand in hand.
Exactly. It's it just makes sense. It's so logical. All of this is very illogical. It's wild when we're the radical ones when it's like, well, actually, this is like the most logical answer right now. There is so much money. I was doing some tabling this weekend at an Earth Day event, and we were talking with so many people who were interested in what we were doing about how, you know, everyone is always saying to any of these kind of public solutions, oh, with what money? And it's like, all of the money that is going to private companies. Like, we have the money, actually. There's a lot of, obviously, there's a lot of money being made right now. And it should be our money. We're the ones who are generating that by buying all of these goods. So it should be our money to be able to take back and be able to reinvest it in public solutions that work for us. And I think it's tricky to think about in everyday life, because the savings of it all doesn't really feel as good as, or it's, it doesn't feel, or people can't really feel savings. They can feel losing a lot. Mm-hmm. But like, for example, like the UK, a study was found that like, because of their investments in renewables and because of their energy profile shifting a little bit more towards renewables, it's nowhere near the amount that it should be, but it's still the kind of, weaning off of fossil fuels has saved the country $1 billion already just since the beginning of this oil crisis. And obviously that's not necessarily amounting to people having thicker pockets right now, but it's one of those like weird contradictory like mental exercises that like politics is kind of hard at conveying, where it's like, you don't know this, but you're actually better off, and like if we hadn't done this, we'd be worse off. It's like it doesn't really work comms wise. Like, people are like, okay,
by the way, you just dodged a bullet.
Yeah, like yeah,
what,
like,
bullet?
Okay, no. Like, I'm still hurting, but okay. Like, but I think like that is kind of the logic we have to play at, and that's like the kind of thinking of, I mean, that's why it's like kind of difficult to communicate the benefits of long-term solutions, period, is because, you know, these things are not immediately felt. They will be largely benefited over time and will pay dividends the longer that takes. But obviously, things are happening in such immediacy right now. And so, which is why the thing is, If we're on an immediate timeline, then the thing to look at is these excess profits that are also happening in that immediate timeline. If we're gonna play the timeline game, then fine, let's play it. Okay, who's making that much profit? Then give it back to us now. You know, like, totally. Let's play that game then.
Yeah, yeah. No, the amount of profits is nuts. I had a few other numbers to sort of compare. So the total budget for the STM, Montreal Transit, for a year is $1.8 billion. So again, total oil and gas profits, $90 billion. STM budget, $1.8 billion. So I'm sure, like, within that, $90 billion, you could easily make all public transit in Canada free. I don't have all the numbers, but I think you can easily make all of it free, probably add some new subway lines just for the hell of it. And then another thing, the total budget for Quebec's healthcare and social services spending is $61.9 billion. So this is what I'm thinking about this week, because I am in an extremely personal healthcare crisis and just having a lot of trouble getting care for chronic pain, which is a whole other story. But it is maddening that, like, I don't have a family doctor, and like, I really need an MRI, but the wait time is a year. I'm just thinking about all of this money that is being made by oil and gas, and thinking about, like, God, I would really like if this went towards like expanding our like doctor training programs, or like purchasing more MRI machines and stuff. Like, there's just like so much need right now. And it's not that there's no money.
Yeah, there's so much need, and it's just really not being distributed at all. It's I was just having so many conversations this weekend about how I just don't understand what people are doing with that money. I don't even understand, like, what, I mean, that's a whole other show, but like, I'm like, what are you doing with like millions and millions, if I can't even conceive of $1 billion?
Like, I know. I like both, like, you know, like, money is stressful right now, and like, I, you know, I do get stressed by it, and I'm just doing my taxes, and yeah, I owe more than I thought. But I like also think about like my dream life, and it's like, not that much. It wouldn't cost that much more than I make right now. Like, I just want to go to some nice restaurants and just, like, you know, take an Uber every now and then.
Well, and, like, they do those exercises where it's like, oh, if Taylor Swift, like, oh, she gave like all of her bus drivers like $1 million bonus. And it's like, for an average person who's making like, I don't know, $70,000, that's like the equivalent of like them spending like an extra $5 or $10. Maybe not proportionally right, but it's like such a drop in her mm-hmm. like ocean of money, because she's such a billionaire that like $100,000 to her is like whatever. Here, you know, it's so casual because people are just so rich. And like, speaking of Taylor Swift, I looked up like the amount of revenue that her Eras Tour generated is like $2 billion. And so imagine how much everyone was going cuckoo about how her tour was stimulating the U.S. economy like post-COVID. And it really did, like people yeah. were like, wow, she's saving the U.S. like literally people are back, like hotels are being used, like it was actually a very important like $2 billion investment into the U.S. economy. But also, that's only $2 billion. What could be done by 40, like times 45
yeah.
from the excess profits tax? Like, it's just like, it's again, like, so like $90 billion is inconceivable. It's just really wild. But I guess we can just go straight into kind of thinking about the $2 billion dollars that are being made. So basically, like, the profiteering that is happening by private companies primarily. But anyone also who has any sort of stake in oil companies will be profiting too. And so that might be like individual people who are investing in oil. That probably means, actually, now that I think of it, like probably any institution that has investments in oil and gas right now, their endowments are probably really increasing right now.
Yeah, so like doing my taxes, I'm like, what a fool I am that my investments are in environmentally friendly.
But I'm like, are universities that haven't divested yet, are they making money right now?
Yeah,
like probably their endowments are. So in a weird, like, perverse way, the post-secondary crisis is being saved by oil. Anyway, that's but I think what I'm trying to get at is, like, you know, the government of Alberta, for example, they do have stakes in oil and gas, of course, and they've actually made they estimated to receive $4 billion from the sector, and that in the last 8 weeks alone has jumped to $10.6 billion, so like a $6 billion jump. A lot of that, maybe those are national. Okay, let's forget those numbers because I don't want to be, you know, held to that.
No misinformation. But basically, on the radio.
Yeah, we're doing our best. Hold on. But I did, these are from some searches. Alberta has made quite a bit of money, and they were projecting a provincial deficit that has now actually been remedied by their excess profits made from this oil crisis. And so some of the money is being kind of recuperated by public funds, just simply because some public governments, some provincial governments are like directly tied into the oil and gas success, which is, you know, unsurprising for Alberta. But that's the case too federally as well. And so the federal government has actually, I think those numbers that I just said are federal. And so we're actually taking home around $2.4 billion to $6.4 billion in additional profits from unexpected profits from this oil crisis. And I guess when we come back from the break, I'll tell you what Canada is trying to do with that excess profits. So. You're listening to Towards a Common Horizon on CJLO 1690, and stay tuned for a little bit more discussion on excess profit taxes and excise gas taxes and all of these words that sound really similar but are actually different. So we'll tell you a little bit more later.
Ultimate Comic Haven at Crossover Comics. Unleash your inner geek with the best selection of graphic novels, manga, games like Pokemon and Magic, in-store events, merch, and more. Our knowledgeable and friendly staff have got your back with awesome recommendations for your next read. Score big with a free account. Enjoy comic subscriptions and membership discounts. Be in on the action at 3560 Notre Dame West in St. Henry, right near Metro Lionel Blue. Crossover Comics, sharing your passions since 2012.
Do you like bubble baths? Hot cocoa on cold night? Snuggling up with a sweetie and listening to the radio? Well, if you answered yes to at least two of those, might I suggest Advice by the Fireplace, CJLO's number one easy listening comedy advice talk radio show hosted by me, Delilah Karen. We bring on a guest or two from the Montreal comedy world to answer real advice questions and maybe share a few funny stories along the way. Advice by the Fireplace, every Wednesday from 5 p.m. to 6 p.m. right here on CJLO 1690. Oh, also, I love you.
And we're back. You're listening to Towards a Common Horizon on CGLO 1690. We're a show that is here every Sunday, every other Sunday at 8 p.m. and we chat all things climate and politics. I'm Hope and I'm joined here by Haley.
Hello again.
And yeah, we've just been chatting about the oil crisis and lots of excesses that have come from it. So we just talked before the break about how the Canadian federal government has earned an extra $2.4 billion from the oil crisis, and they have decided to use that excess profit to what Carney is kind of calling it is an affordability solution for Canadians, specifically at the pumps. And so he's decided to have a temporary suspension on the excise tax, so government tax on gas, diesel, and aviation fuel from starting to tomorrow, Monday, April 20th, to Labor Day. And so this tax vacation is expected to cost about that $2.4 billion. So that same the same amount of revenue that was made from the excess profits. And this is interesting. This is an interesting suspension. And many advocates, I mean, I guess including us, we can just call it a fossil fuel subsidy because essentially that's what it is. He's kind of putting, what is that expression? I'm so bad with expressions, like a wolf in sheep's clothing or whatever. Like he's trying to pull it off as an affordability policy measure when it's really just giving more money to these oil companies that are already profiting.
Yeah. And like, I don't blame people who are like, it makes sense that people are like, thank God, like 10 cents off at the pump. Like it is so expensive. And so like, I'm not at any way upset with people who are happy, but it's like, okay, they're still paying like 50 cents more and now we're getting 10 cents back. So, and it's just like, it's like not doing anything regulatory to stop these massive profits. And then the other thing is like, it's, so yes, there is like money that the federal government has made off oil that they're like putting towards it. But like, we could have like gone after, these excess profits more. And like, there's just like a danger of like, with like removing funding from the federal government, because this money is like ours, is a public purse, and it goes towards stuff that is important, like healthcare and roads and all those good things. And so yeah, it's saying like, oh, oil companies, you're having like a field day, people are mad at you, don't worry, like we'll pay, like kind of pay them off.
It's paying them off. Like, it's fully
to not be mad at you.
Well, and what is interesting is if he really cared about affordability, because I agree, like obviously people, any relief for people right now is totally understandable, but what's frustrating is it's not even that much relief. There have been people who have kind of crunched the numbers and they've said there's estimates that drivers will only save about $77 during this time, or about $17 per month. And I looked at like the methods for this estimate, and that's like assuming bad fuel efficiency too. So it's like, it's not even going to be that much money saved. Like that's like, depending on your car, like a tank and a little bit, maybe not even a full tank of gas. Certainly not if you're a truck driver. And so $17,
like, not a tank a month, like a tank till Labor Day.
Till Labor Day, exactly. $17 a month. I mean, what even? That is
not even lunch.
Yeah. So, and so, you know, my kind of napkin math showed that $2.4 billion directly distributed to 15.7 million Canadian households. If you just divide that, that could just give a blank check of $150 to each of those households, which would be much more. That's more than double, basically, the savings in gas. And so, mm-hmm. and not all households are drivers. So then, obviously, you know, that would just be more equitably distributed to everyone too. And so, it's if he really cared about affordability, he would just not do the excise tax. He wouldn't cut the excise tax, and he would just directly distribute that $2.4 billion to households directly. But B, he would have the guts to obviously do an actual excess profits tax as well.
Yeah. And again, like, yeah, other countries are like tackling this different ways. Like, and so Abby Lewis, the new leader of the federal NDP, has pointed to how France has implemented, regulations saying that corporations can only charge or like make so much of a profit margin on gas. There's been some criticism of the French policy. I was reading that it's like more at the like gas station level, and what they're saying is like the profits are being made and added more at the refinery level. So like there's stuff to be done there, but I'm really excited that we have like an NDP leader now who's like willing to make these like bold proposals. I would say I like almost like went deep into like a research hole being like, how do like caps on profit work? Anyways, it's just like exciting that other solutions are being proposed and saying like we could actually be tackling this corporate greed, and just like thinking about like investing in ways that we could just like not be at the freaking whim of these oil companies in the long run. And like, I think I talked about it a bit last week, but like Canada is like incredibly well set up for renewables and like has the potential to be a renewable superpower because we have a ton of land, pretty sparsely populated, and the potential for wind energy is massive, massive, massive here. And then also like offshore tidal is huge. And so, you know, if we're like, if we could get to that point, like we could be in such a better position right now. And also it can be small things. I mean, probably because of like winters, we're not as well set up. But Pakistan, and other countries are having huge success with, balcony solar. And this is actually just starting to be legalized in the US, which is really cool. So this is like, I think a lot of them are being sold, at IKEA. I don't know if people in Pakistan are buying them, but I think in Germany. Yeah, they've got IKEA. And so it's like pretty cheap, and it's just a little solar panel that you're putting on your balcony, and there just needs to be like a regulatory change, and then you can like have this solar panel plug into like into the wall plug and feed energy back into the grid that way, which is so cool that it's like not requiring massive retrofitting or anything. Like it's just like you buy a solar panel, put it on your porch. And so yeah, it's just like thinking about all these solutions that could get us to both avoiding the worst of the climate crisis and like, you know, affordability. Like people who have balcony solar are like making money selling the energy from their balcony.
No, seriously. I mean, so we we also talked about this a few weeks ago too, about how after the 80s oil crisis, a lot of the Scandinavian countries retrofitted all of their homes to be more insulated, to be able to lower the energy required to heat their homes. And so we could be doing that in terms of retrofitting, but also just simply even implementing new building codes. So that's a bit tricky. Building codes might be a bit more of a provincial situation, but still, I mean, they can do it too. So any sort of building codes that require or building codes outline how new builds are to be built in terms of you know, what's most important here is like if they're hooked up to gas or not. And so there's actually certain provinces that have started to phase out gas. So actually Quebec and BC are provinces, I believe, that do have building codes now that are requiring new builds to not have gas hookups. So we're already phasing out in some provinces, but it would be great to be able to have that mandated across the country. And in like the UK has just done it now as kind of a response to this oil crisis. actively understanding that, like, being able to have fewer homes that are vulnerable to these crises will allow for households then to not be as vulnerable and be able to be more resilient and ideally, yeah, have a bit more energy sovereignty once more renewables are being able to be fed into the grid. And so, yeah, in Canada, that looks like investing in an east-west energy grid rather than a pipeline. So there's been like talks so far since Carney's been elected about, you know, there's been murmurs at least of an east-west pipeline and certainly some large infrastructure goals and conversations around that. But what really needs to be happening if we want to be building big infrastructure, if we want to be talking about nation building, if we have to, it should be about building an east-west energy grid, which David Suzuki Foundation, they released a report in 2022 said that outlined the costs and kind of priced it all out and did a feasibility study. And at that time, they said 24 billion. It would cost to implement that by 2035. So not even that long of a timeline, not that much in all respects in terms of the excess profits that are being made. It's certainly within the budget of excess profits to invest into an east-west energy grid, which would then set us up to be completely independent and allow for us to invest in huge renewables and have an energy independency within Canada. And that's it. It's such yeah. It's simple. It really is. And it's just completely nonsensical that we're not doing anything to just make that happen immediately, honestly. Yeah.
And for people who are not energy nerds, the importance of the east-west grid is basically, you know, we have, like, this is the answer to when people are like, oh, but the sun doesn't shine and the wind doesn't blow. And it's like, you need a grid that is bigger than a weather system. Because then once you have a very big grid, you know, the sun doesn't always shine, but it's shining somewhere and the wind is blowing somewhere. And it just like allows you to have like average it out. And what's also really good about the grid is it reduces the need for backup battery storage because batteries, you know, requires a ton of mining and like has its own issues with like a lot of this mining is like very toxic. And like in the global south with like a lot of like dodgy practices. So the more we can rely on sort of like energy grids. I mean, there's critical minerals involved in the energy grid as well. It's like a lot of steel and aluminum. But anyways, it just like creates like this grid where we can like shunt energy around and have the average workout. And it means that we'll be able to deal with fluctuating weather systems.
So yeah. Basically, it's all within reach, and it makes very little sense why we're not doing so. Why we're not, you know, frothing at the bit to make it happen. I mean, unsurprisingly, conservatives at this announcement of the suspension of the excise tax, I should like enunciate a little bit more. The conservatives were saying that this tax holiday. Is not enough. It should just be forever. And so
it is interesting how like the conservatives, like in the liberals becoming more conservative, like they're kind of like eating the conservatives' lunch. Yeah. So their narrative just has to be like
everything
that but more, which is like kind of anyways. But I'm hopeful. My dream is that the kind of politics that Avi Lewis and the NDP are pushing, you know, will address affordability in the same way that conservative voters are looking for, like being serious about how the status quo isn't working. And so, yeah, offering real alternatives.
It's interesting, too. So there's a group called Climate Caucus, and they are a group of climate-minded municipal elected officials, so mayors and councillors who've kind of found this group and involved themselves with like-minded councillors and mayors. They've released a statement in response to this suspension of the excise tax on gas. And the chair of the board and also a city councillor in BC has said the prime minister should not be further subsidizing a massively profitable fossil fuel industry. His government must ensure that local communities are equipped to permanently shield themselves from fossil fuel price hikes. This means investing in mass electrification of the economy, including municipal buildings and fleets. So, yeah, really kind of pointing towards the kind of lack of tangibility that this solution has in terms of the long-term effects. And so I think municipalities are a really interesting player in all of this, and they're often forgotten about with large infrastructure projects and with large global crises. But municipalities is where all of these global crises are felt at the front door. And so, you know, like this counselor has said, so much depends on how just our everyday world, like involving buildings and transportation, like those are municipal governed areas, and so much depends on the ability for municipalities with federal funding, with provincial funding, to be able to invest in transitions for transitioning an entire municipal public transit fleet to be electrified, and therefore making them less vulnerable to these sort of oil and gas hikes, or transitioning municipal buildings to be all retrofitted and being able to have heat pumps available. You know, we could be spending all this money to buy heat pumps for every single building in Canada, and we'd still have money left over. And that would be incredible, because that would, A, cheapen everyone's electricity bills, and B, prep us for that east-west energy grid. Oh my god, east-west energy grid.
You should call it that, rebranding. But
yeah, true.
Energy pipeline.
That you know, that we really want. And so these are solutions that should be happening at all levels of government, and certainly should not be forgotten about in terms of cities being left behind, and people and everyday kind of solutions being left behind, in the interest of, you know, these larger mysticisms of global capitalism that I think is really easy to get swept up by.
Yeah, and these solutions are being actively cut by this government. Like the
public transit being cut.
$5 billion in cuts last year from public transit. And like, I think some other like home and retrofit programs were cut.
Yeah, actually, there was a huge, the home retrofit, energy retrofit program existed for a few years. And actually a lot of homeowners were able to access like federal grants to be able to help with their retrofitting and installing of heat pumps and whatnot. But that fund's dried up now, and it has not been reinvested in.
Yeah. And it's like so important, because it's like that, you know, the like initial investment to get a heat pump is large, and people need help with it, but there's like so much long-term savings that can come of it. And I think it's also really important that we have programs that help make sure that like these are available to renters, so that like, you know, you don't always like get to choose what the heating system is in your home. And if you have a home that is on gas, or even it's like not that used in most of Canada, but in the Atlanta, Canada, there's still a lot of homes that are on heating oil. Yep. And so
I've paid my fair share of home heating.
Oh yes, you've done your time in Halifax. So yeah, there's like a lot of like shocks that are happening right now. And if like that, you know, home retrofit program had been in place, like that would be actively helping affordability right now. It feels like it's just like a real freaking like death cult in Canada right now.
Yeah, we're just spiraling.
Also, also the way that we're like, okay, yeah, white knuckling it with oil and gas, and then also all of the like investment that the federal government is doing right now in military and war. We were talking last week about there's like, I think it's $8.1 billion invested in making Canada increase its weapons manufacturing, and those weapons are being sold to the US. And something that we're talking about of like just like the like evil loop of this is like the F-35 fighter jets that are being used in this war in Iran, that are bombing Iran, that are causing the Strait of Hormuz to be closed, they every single one of them has parts made in Canada. And some of those parts are only made in Canada. I think it's like the bulkheads and like some other things are only made in Canada. So every F-35 jet in the world has parts that are made in Canada. And so like we are contributing through the military like industrial complex to this like global problem of violence, of, you know, Trump trying to do coups, and then that's like creating these global energy crises that's then coming back home to haunt us. And so it's just like just infuriating.
And apparently there's infinite money for increasing defense budgets, and somehow the question of where is the money for any sort of public investment always comes up. And so it's this like, yeah, really, again, just illogical cycle that we're in. So somehow there's always money for defense, which is going towards these wars, which is going to thicken the pockets of oil executives and oil companies. But all of those steps involve losses for the public and the average Canadian, and so, and for everyone around the world. And so, you know, of course we're in an affordability crisis.
Yeah.
Every single step of the way, we are paying for war. We're paying for oil and gas to continue being a viable industry, even though it is
like the free market is saying no.
Yeah. Like every, like, yes, like obviously we're struggling. Obviously there's an affordability crisis because we're paying for it. Mm-hmm. We're the ones who are actually causing, we're the ones who are paying for this affordability crisis because we are being robbed every single day. And our government, our public government, who should be, you know, acting in the interest of the everyday person, simply is not.
Mm-hmm. I think the other thing that's interesting is often like the subsidies to different industries is like talked about in terms of job creation. But yeah, what we talked about last time is like war and weapons manufacturing is like one of the worst, like just dollars to jobs,
right?
One of the worst, because it's like incredibly specialized technology and like all the money is going to that and not to like jobs. And I think, you know, for a long time oil and gas has been a creator of jobs in the Canadian economy, and I think it does have this sort of like special weird quality of being something that like you can make six figures with a high school education, and that has been you know, like I think like a really special and like difficult thing. But we're seeing like in the oil and gas industry, as profits go up, jobs are like flatlining and decreasing, and there's like a lot of automation that's happening in the heavy haulers and all this. And so like when we continue to subsidize these industries, we are losing jobs. And then when you think about like the, when we looked at what is the best investment in jobs, it's stuff like healthcare and education, which again, I need to go to the frickin' doctor. So I, please, Mark Carney.
I know. Well, I mean, that's the thing. Like if we care about workers and like, yeah, oil and gas workers, they're not winning here either. They're losing all the time too. Like no working person right now is winning in Canada. That's just the truth.
Yeah, the workers don't get like I think a special dividend.
No, they're not getting war.
I might be wrong. There might be. I don't know everything about it.
Well, execs probably are, but the average worker is not getting war bonuses.
Yeah, no.
Like that's not happening.
Not getting a piece of the pie.
And so their
costs are going up like the rest of us. Like they have to buy gas, they have to buy food, their costs like, are going up.
The war bonus that the only acceptable war bonus that I'll accept is an excess profits tax and a redistribution of wealth. And mm-hmm. and whether or not that's a redistribution directly into our pockets in some sort of, you know, benefit, or that's a direct investment in social services, those are the only acceptable means that I can think of that I will accept any sort of war profiteering. I don't want anything to do with it.
Yeah.
If we're going to make money, then at least make our lives better.
Yeah.
You know?
And again, this is like not like I think if it was like making money like directly off the Iranian people, they would have like a different calculus of need to go directly back to this. This is just sort of like money being made because the price of oil is up and just opportunism.
Opportunism, extractive. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Speculation.
But it's money coming right out of people's pockets right now just because.
It's our money.
It's our money.
Ultimately, it's our money. So give it back to us.
Give it back.
All right. That's our show. We're here every other Sunday at CJLO 1690. Tune in if you want to hear more about all things climate, affordability, politics. Follow us on Instagram. We're at Common Horizon, something like that. And we'll see you
Common
in
Horizon
a few weeks.
Commune.
Common Horizon Commune.
Commune.
Yeah. All right. Well, see you in a few weeks. Have a great night.
By this time next year, you'd be rich. So when they gonna pay you back?